Hello, everybody. My name is Daniel Prince, and I am the host of the Once Bitten podcast. This is a podcast focused on Bitcoin. It's my mission to interview as many people as I can around the different aspects of Bitcoin and help people understand exactly what Bitcoin could mean for them and for their families and for their future. I hope you enjoy the show. Thank you so much for listening. Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Once Bitten podcast. Joining me on this show, Uber Pleb Storm Jib. You might have heard him years ago when I first heard him come onto the scene on John's podcast, Bitcoin Rapid Fire. And ever since then, I thought it was such a great idea to get the plebs on the podcasts. And I know John still does that as well. I love doing it, and many more people out there are doing it as well. Podcasts have ballooned in popularity ever since then, and forevermore, it would seem. But we do need more voices in the space, that is for sure. And thank you, Storm Jib, for coming on and sharing your story. Before we get into the show, please make sure you're stacking some sats. There are very good companies out there that can help you do that. Please do your own research in your own jurisdiction. Find those Bitcoin-only companies that also have a focus on education. Bitcoin only and education. If it's a shitcoin casino, steer very clear. They do not care about you. They want your money on your commissions. Basically, they want you trading in and out as much as humanly possible. That's how they make their money. So look out for the Bitcoin-only companies. Where can you find them? Ask your Bitcoiner friends. Get to a meetup. Do the research. Try it and get to a conference and figure out what is the best service for you. In the States, you can look into Swan Bitcoin, swan.com. Get over there. Use the code BITTEN to get yourself a free $10. They have all kinds of services over there. So do Relay on this side of the pond in Europe. RELAI.ch. Both companies very well known in the space. Both companies funded by Bitcoin only venture capital. So they're sticking around and they are growing. And this is a very good way for you to start your journey down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. Same for Coin Corner, who are based out of the UK. So they can service all of you Britcoiners over there with your pounds, but they are also available to the Euro plebs as well. So Coin Corner, hit the link in the show notes, get a free £10 worth of Bitcoin with your first purchase of over £100. And if you want to go KYC free, you can use HODL HODL. That is a global peer-to-peer trading and lending platform brought to you by the same people that put on the Baltic Honey Badger Conference. And we'll get to that in a second. Firstly, though, you want to learn about CoinJoin. When you take self-custody of the coins, if you run them through a CoinJoin service, you are disconnecting your link to where you bought those coins in the first place. So you're upping your privacy. WasabiWallet.io is the best place to go and start learning about this and trialing it very quickly. Just download the software, pull some Bitcoin off one of these exchanges or platforms that you've been using, run it through the CoinJoin, and voila, you're done. That's your first CoinJoin. Then, of course, it has to go into cold storage. You want an offline device, signing device. You can use the Bitbox. That's Bitbox O2 hardware wallet, Bitcoin only, brought to you by bitbox.swiss/bitten. And use the code BITTEN, you'll get a 5% discount. You can track all of this as well whilst you're doing this, whilst you're buying your Bitcoin and taking self-custody and trying it through the CoinJoin by going to mempool.space and tracking the TXID and learning more about how Bitcoin works and what the mempool is and what the blockchain looks like. So get over to mempool.space and check that out. Use it as well as a tool to orange pill your friends and family. All right, so many conferences coming up, guys. You can use the code BITTEN for most, if not all, conferences coming up. If not, let me know and I'll see if the guys can help you out with a discount. But if you want to get to Surfing Bitcoin, that's the end of this month at time of release in August. You can also get to the Baltic Honey Badger in September. Liberty in Our Lifetime, middle of October, brought to you by the Free Cities Foundation. You can get a 10% discount using the code BITTEN. Bitcoin Atlantis is going to be in March, and Bitcoin Amsterdam again in October. I skipped one there. So Bitcoin Atlantis is in March of 2024. It's going to be a huge one. It's going to be excellent to be over on the island of Madeira and hanging out with all of the plebs there. We're really looking forward to going as a family. Final shill, join Orange Pill App. Connect, go find your people. You know you need to. And enjoy this rip with Stormjib. All right, we are recording. Stormjib, good to see you, brother.
Hey, hello, Daniel.
Now, it's great to have you on the show, because I remember listening to you with John Vallis. I think we're going back a handful, 2 years at least.
Longer, I believe. I want to say 18, 19. That wow. It was later than 18, and it was earlier than 20.
All right.
But I can't be sure. Maybe it was 20 for all I know, but it was a while. I was really touched by John connects with people beautifully. He really is so broad in what he records and who he converses with. Great guy.
And that's the thing about that episode. I remember thinking, we need more plebisodes. Because these are so great. These are stories from the ground, you know, from just normal people who are talking about how Bitcoin has changed their lives, their way of thinking, how they come to find it. And so when I started my podcast, I can't remember if maybe it was 20 you were on there, because I think I'd already started mine rolling January, right at the end of January 2020. I remember having a chat with John saying, I got to do this, man. Like, it was inspiring to hear the plebs come out of nowhere, and he definitely lit the torch on that. And Brady was doing the same kind of thing as well, just having some plebs on with his Citizen Bitcoin podcast. It's good to reminisce about those old days, those old pods.
Yeah, absolutely.
How much has changed?
I feel like the just space becomes broader. It's like everything at every level of Bitcoin's evolution exists, and then new things come. And so we retain what came prior, but new things get added to the culture. So, I mean, you see how interesting the last year has been. I mean, I find while the last year has been frustrating with some of the things about the issue with the Luna and whatever, that Canadian exchange owner that went missing, Quadriga, CX, and all these insolvency events and all these things emphasizing the importance of holding our own keys. That's been interesting to me how that's all come to roost around again, because that must have been what was going on back in 14 after Gox. I imagine it was before my time. But to me, that's what brought the awareness of the importance of self-custody. You saw how people at Gox got wrecked, and you're like, wow, better not let that happen to me. It's sort of that sort of thing, I feel.
For sure, man. And we get bigger and bigger every day. More and more people join the network every single day. And with that comes new voices, new ideas, new directions. Some are going to be not the best of actors, but on the whole, when you get out and actually meet the Bitcoiners out there, just the pure plebs, it's so uplifting. And I just got back from BTC Prague last week, huge event here in Europe. And you just leave those places just feeling so damn bullish on everything.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. For me, the one thing that my whole, if we're going to touch base on the how we came from it, or where are we trying to have our conversation run? Like, what are we trying to cover today?
We're gonna cover all the things. Actually, Lawrence just walked in to rescue the podcast. So,
fair enough.
And
ask you
the first question. But yeah, what we'll do is we'll cover your rabbit hole story and where you've come from and what you're doing, and then we'll get into any tangential stuff that comes along. But what do you want to fire away with, Lauren?
Fair.
Wait, you're talking. Oh, I thought you were talking. Okay, sorry. Why did you decide to come on the podcast? Out of all the podcasts in the world, you chose this one.
Well, there's a number of Bitcoin podcasts I like for a variety of reasons, but if I could say what I appreciate about Once Bitten as a podcast, it's conversational and approachable. It's not like one of the more intensely over the top technical ones that leave you drowning to understand what's being discussed, where those are nice to listen to as well. I just like that it's it discusses a lot of different broad subjects. Now, specifically, what I hope to take from this conversation is there's some things your father is particularly knowledgeable in, and we actually have some overlap in some of our interests. Like, from what I understand, I believe your father has traveled by boat to a great degree. I haven't read the book Choose Life. Am I correct about that?
No, we did mainly home swapping around the world, and we were getting there generally by flights or driving.
But all right, yeah, and that's great clarification. The other thing that I think is tremendously interesting is your emphasis on home education in that part. So I hope to take away sort of like the explain like I'm five version of home education, your sort of primary and initial thoughts. And I don't know if that's covered on another pod you did, but your insights to that I'm interested in taking away. And the picture of the sailboat on the cover of your book, I think, in the silhouette of the sun, where I may be just transposing that to that image. I don't even know if I'm right or wrong. I don't know. Just kind of, that's what I take away from you. I view you as a traveler, as an educator, as a Bitcoiner. So I was just looking to take that away. And myself, I view myself as a few things. I'm a Bitcoiner. I also happen to be a registered nurse. I'm an avid sailor, and I'm growing as a commercial mariner. Like, I work on the water. So I guess I'm a fan and a listener, to answer you, Lauren. I appreciate the podcast, and we were in a thread one day, and I responded to your father that I said I'd love to come on and record, and he was like, yeah, let's do it. And then we scheduled this, and here we are. So that's your long-winded question answer. There you go.
Sorry, my earphone just fell out. I think I might have another question.
Mm-hmm.
So, if I'm correct, do you live on a boat?
I have one that is livable, but I don't live on it. So, my boat, my more livable boat, is a Westsail 32 Cutter. It's a kind of a boat that gave birth to the micro cruising movement, like almost like a small RV, recreational vehicle that you could live within. It has a small galley where you could prepare food. Has small living quarters and place for stores and provisions. So these boats, while small, they're quite seaworthy, and they could take you to various small island locations in the Pacific or anywhere else in the world for that matter. So they kind of started the process of people shorthanded crews taking privately owned small boats to places as a mode of travel. So that's something I've aspired to do ever since I met a couple from the UK up in Kodiak, Alaska, back in 2005, where I fished for seine for salmon as a job one summer. And I was a summer recreational sunfish sailor. I never realized people went so far on their own boats, and it just kind of opened my eyes. So from that point forward, I got more and more into keel boats and boats that you could live upon. But yeah, it's kind of a goal of mine, but no, I don't live on it yet. I live in a small building at a friend's lake house because the price is right and the setting's beautiful. So there I am.
That's very nice. My question is, how long have you stayed on the boat? Have you ever like stayed on there for a night?
I'll answer the question by saying the longest I've ever stayed on a boat, and that would be a time that an older sailor back in 2019 needed assistance moving a boat from Solomon's Island, Maryland on the Chesapeake Bay to Daytona Beach, Florida. And a route we chose to take is something called the Intercoastal Waterway here on the East Coast of the United States, which is a series of bays and canals and natural rivers that you can go from basically like Norfolk, Virginia, all the way to Key West with a minimum of outside exposure to the ocean. So it's a waterway system that allows for really the inland rivers, and the ICW is all about the movements of goods and effective commerce. And it's part of what's incredible about the maritime space. People don't think about, like, when we think about trains, how much goods they move, much the same tug and barge are similar. So the answer to that question is I would say about a little better than 2 months, I was helping Jay move his sailboat. And we would stop on a nightly basis, either at anchor or take up a transient marina slip. And you'd see what was there locally, maybe walk around, see what's there. And so I guess 60 days is my longest. And on my personal boat, I've done a passage from New Orleans to Florida in the process of moving my personal boat closer to where I live at home in New Jersey on the northern east coast of the United States. That boat came to me from California via truck. And at the time I purchased it, I couldn't afford to pay the expensive overland trucking to bring it all the way home to New Jersey. So my cousin at the time and still was living in New Orleans, and he does things with boats down there. We chose to slip it in New Orleans for about 7 years while working on it, projects, so forth. And only recently, as of 2021, has it begun to come home. And now it's finally in Barnegat, New Jersey, where I just have a few more projects to do. So I'm in this slow process of like trying to become that sailboat traveler. So it's like you have hurdles. You have to like purchase the boat. You have to like save the money so you can afford provisions so you could be largely without work while traveling. So 60 days and 5 days are your respective answers for how long passage.
All right.
Wow.
Well, good questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Something
to look up that just concluded recently. So there is the Golden Globe race just concluded, and Kristen Neuschafer has been the victor of that. She is a woman from South Africa who was one of the entrants. There was about 16 boats to enter, and I want to say something like 5 or 6 boats to finish. And it's a nonstop single-handed race modeled after the 1970 Golden Globe race, which Sir Robin Knox was the victor in that. And it's this race where you're on a very simple displacement boat. You have only rudimentary things, not fancy modern electronics like GPS and so forth. And these single-handed entrants spend basically just about nearly a year going around the globe independently with only themselves on the boat. It's a very incredible feat. The solitude they face, it's almost it's like doing an Everest of sailing, if you will. Like they go down under Cape Horn underneath the South American continent, which is one of the more ferocious places to transit the world's waterways. It's pretty wild.
A year.
But anyway, thank you for the questions. I don't recall the exact time. Thank you. You're welcome. I want to say it's something like it's every bit of 6 months, and it may be as long as 10. I don't know if the exact time it started. But yeah, there's actually the contrast between the entrance in that original 1971. There was a man named Donald Crowhurst, who was a newspaperman from the UK, who built some sort of forward-thinking trimaran who was hoping to win. Now, his campaign ran short of finances, and he leveraged it against the value of his newspaper business. And had he won, he would have done even more fantastically, and his wealth would have grown and things would have been fantastic. And he bet so big on this boat being so good that he thought he would do so well. He shortly thereafter proved to himself that he didn't have the skills of being a mariner, nor were his vessel up to par for what he was facing. And he began to fall behind, and he began lying and misreporting positions via SSB radio. And eventually it became apparent that he kind of killed himself and his vessel washed ashore somewhere in the islands or the coast of South America or something. So he buckled from the psychological pressures of solo sailing and the way he leveraged his life, which is kind of an interesting parallel to like what Fiat does sometimes. You know, he was able to gamble on his own existence and leverage all his assets in a way that are wholly unnatural. And it led him into this position where on a hard money, you wouldn't be able to do it. And the other entrance that was very interesting was Joshua's. Oh my God, why can't I remember his name? Well, he's a fantastic sailor. And I want to say he's of French descent. And he, as he rounded the Cape of Good Hope under Africa, he at that point viewed himself as a citizen of the ocean, and he did not wish to depart and turn north to the UK to finish and win the race. And he decided to go another lap around the bottom of the world, forfeiting his potential victory, because he was ahead of Sir Robin Knox Johnson at that point. But Knox Johnson turned north and he did win. But what a challenging and dramatic race. Like this year, there was a rescue of an entrant by another race participant where something went afoul with their vessel. There's other events I can't recall, but I mean, it's something else. I mean, we live in a world that's 70% water and it is very much untamed. It is something that it's raw. It doesn't have a lick of care for us. So anything that you're going to do to preserve your well-being on the water is something you must do defensively and do for yourself. It's a high responsibility setting where you really need to take inventory of what risks exist and what your preparations are. And there's a saying that goes, you can't lie to the ocean. And it just basically means that like, what it is what it is, and it's going to find your weaknesses. If you're not adequately prepared, you can't just bullshit it. It's just, like, it's going to show.
So, and so anyway, few of us, so few of us can even sail, right?
Yeah, I try to always make it. Some people get all excited about what they can or can't do on the water. I like to believe everything is teachable skills and boil it down. My rudimentary nickel speech on sailing is, if the wind was blowing from the ceiling to the floor, you think about a pizza. There's two slices out of the pizza, roughly, a little better than that, you cannot sail into. And the reason for that is sails drive us by generating lift, much like a wing of an airplane. When you go too close to the wind on either tack, your sails begin to become a flag. They're no longer generating lift. They're stalled. Now your boat's not being driven. You're not sailing effectively any longer. So there's two ways to solve that. You either turn down wind on either tack to make the sail fill, to make the sail drive, or you could trim the sail in more via the sheets. Granted, there's so much more complication to layer on top of that, like, you know, from fixing your position to being aware of currents to sea state to, you know, hardware of a boat. But at its simplest, if you're ever at a all-inclusive or someplace where there's a Hobie Cat or a sunfish on the beach, hop in the thing. When the sails start shaking, pull the tiller away from the sail. She'll start to go again. Sails start shaking, trim the sheet. You'll know how to be a basic sailor in the space of 20 minutes if you just fool with it. And then you'll learn to make every problem in the book until you learn to get good at it. But yeah, it is a weird thing in terms of that it's extremely specialized. It's the kind of thing that sailing in mariner's life takes us away from the day to day. Like we go to a boat and say, if you're working on an inland river, pushing wheat down the Mississippi to get it to where it's got to be traded or loaded onto trains, you're away for a couple weeks at a time, 3 weeks at a time doing hitch work. So mariners tend to be out there honing their skills, learning their craft, so forth. And it's very basic things like how to put a eye on like a bollard or a cleat in a way that you're not risking your fingers, how to stand in a manner that you're least likely to be thrown from a pitching deck, all these basic skills, but they're accrued through being out there with other peers that have their time in that say they see something that puts you at risk. They say, hey, Mike, don't put that eye on there like that. You could get distracted and crush your fingers. You put it on like this. It's like anything else specialized and isolated, I guess. But I enjoy it greatly. I think the water's fascinating. It's the greatest interest of my life. And in hindsight, I probably should have listened to my father when I was 19 when he took me on a day trip to SUNY Maritime and said, hey, this might be a good thing for you. I'm kind of coming around it the long way. I'm a house piper, if you will. So I've been working oil boom boat job for 4.5 years. I've had my license since 2016. So I had a small tonnage inland master's license. So it didn't really qualify me to operate a whole lot. I could run small ferries. I can run uninspected passenger vessels. I'm working on deciding what move I want to make next. Do I want to try to climb some sort of maritime career ladder? My most focused career efforts in life have been, I'm an offhand glass blower first in life, where I assisted in making like elaborate goblets, lighting installations, things like that. So like fine arts background, that's what my first degree is in. So that artist life, and that wasn't really for me, in the sense that to be an effective artist in the States, you not only have to be good at making whatever craft or art you make, you need to be good at marketing it. You need to be strong at design. And sometimes I joke around with my glassworking side of myself. I'm a better Indian than a chief. Like, I'm not really that seriously into the design. I'd just rather execute and implement and work with the material. And I wasn't also all that driven to do it from a business perspective. I've traded a few things I've made for like mountain bike tune-ups or other trivial things, but wasn't really a very serious business person at glass. From there, life took me back to New Jersey, and this is a ramble, so unfocused. Back to New Jersey, ended up becoming a fish person while I chose to go to school for nursing because I needed something that could get me money for a boat. I didn't have money for a boat in the early 2000s. And since I had a previous bachelor's, the 2-year associates added on to that to get a nursing degree seemed like the shortest distance between two points to have a in-demand thing that I could get money to purchase a boat. And that's what I did with it. So I've had a couple keel boats since 2007 was when I first bought a small, real bad keel boat. That one's no longer with me. 2012, I bought a Bristol 27, which I've retained, and I like that boat a lot. And I also have my Westsail 32, which I purchased impulsively, sight unseen, without even being able to afford to go visit it. Like, it was nuts, man. Total fiat culture stuff, like burned down a 401k and took a loan and all that stuff. It was hilarious.
Love it, mate. Well, okay.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. You'll be able to take some Bitcoiners out so they can have their boating accidents.
I would love to. Yeah. Any boating accident you like.
So yeah. How then and where, at what point through all of that? I mean, registered nurse, glass blower, sailor. What did you say about house pipe? What was that? I missed that one.
House what?
You said something about piping. I didn't know the term. It was a new term.
It's a term for how you can come to the commercial maritime industry. The house pipe is where a line or an anchor may pass through a hull to let a line to a shore or an anchor down or so forth. And sometimes that's actually where pests get onto the boat. So you can come to a professional maritime career via maritime college or Navy service, which are the more official routes to becoming an officer or maritime professional. Or you could have spent your time as a deckhand in the trade, building skills, testing up, and kind of finding your way. That's a house piper. And you're not going to be as polished as somebody. Like, I read as many books as I can, and I try to expose myself to knowledge, but there's just no substitute for some of these preparations. Like, if you've been to maritime college, you've been exposed to a quantity and quality of education that from the gate, you're going to be pretty damn educated. Now, I would have to bet, though, a lot of people that came to it from working within it, they probably have some pretty good developed chops, in the sense that there's probably some textbook smart maritime college kids that if you just dropped them on a barge somewhere and said, hey, yeah, we need you to wire together these 15 barges and we're going to push them down the Mississippi, they might fail that practical test. You know what I mean? Like, did they pass it in a book someday back when they were trained? Probably. But do they actually possess that inherent applied knowledge to say, yeah, let's set these barges up to make this trip, or that judgment to know, oh, this particular lock or this particular bridge, we're going to split our tow up and we're going to go through with six, and then we're going to come back through with the nine, and then we're going to put them back together. They don't have that. They don't necessarily have that applied knowledge that the people who have been out there working and done it, because the way this industry became a profession, even, I mean, if we back up all the way up to the 1800s, 1860s, sailors were illiterate. They were just people working in the navies or God knows what, living in shanties. They were very just, they were mariners. They were watermen. And then ships' libraries were found. And rather than tie elaborate knot work or work on the traditional maritime crafts such as scrimshaw or elaborate knot work, they would read instead. So it started getting more serious. And then as we went through all our naval history and early conflicts and World War One and World War Two, and merchant vessels became more and more effective and elaborate as a means of transport for goods. Sometime in the early 70s, a system of credentialing came out. And I don't know about it internationally, but I have some idea. It's probably about SOLAS, and I can't name that acronym. But it very much mimics what happens in the U.S. with the Coast Guard. They basically would say if you were already a captain, they'd say, well, Daniel, you've been out here on the river for 15 years. You've been on the oceans for 15 years. Here's your captain's license. And you'd be like, great, I'm a captain now. Or you already were in function. But it wasn't like it is today, in the sense that today you need to pass a test first and you need to have the experience as well. But it's a whole different system, you know what I mean? Whereas like the old way, kind of you really needed to show you could do it and someone would put it in your hands, but you could be deficient in some theoretical formal aspects and still be able to execute. So I guess nowadays you need to be verified to be practical in all those theoreticals, and then the application comes. It's a different way. I don't know. It's so a totally different way.
At what point did Bitcoin enter this story?
Well, but the first rumblings of it, so you always have those few touch points. 2013 was when like the Silk Road and things like that, in my perception, were going about around then. And I personally was interested in the Silk Road in the sense that wanted to buy something through it, and I'd never got the guts to act on it. I mean, I have a nurse's license. I didn't follow through. So I failed to recognize Bitcoin for what Bitcoin was. I just saw it as a tool to buy something I wanted, and I didn't act on it. 2016, similar energy, similar approach, also didn't have the guts to act on it. And then 2017, the blow off top happened. And I recall that it went from a price of like 200 something to like 20,000. And I was like, holy crap, I missed something significant here. I didn't know what yet, but I was like, I got to figure out what the heck this was, because I'm not going to miss it twice. You know what I mean? I figured that it came to be for more than no reason. And so I certainly did come for the gains initially. That was the mental idea. So I was pretty much strictly Bitcoin for like the first 7 months. And then I went through a heavy shit coining period of about like, say, I don't know, like a month, but like two or three of them just sort of sat on a hardware wallet for like a long time before I fully divested from them. I don't know. I just kind of wanted to have some of it because I saw it go by on me. Now, once I was sort of reading about it on Reddit a lot and so forth, I wanted to understand what it was. So I'm reading about Merkle trees and like, what is the SHA-256 algorithm and these 32-bit outputs? And I'm still not super knowledgeable about that stuff, but I try to put my ear to the ground and figure out what works on what. Like, I really like Danny Dokrieger, that former baseball player guy from Cash App. He writes some really cool threads that are very accessible to the non-technical reader. He shared a lot of great insight. There's lots of great guys in this space that just sort of break things down in a way that a non-developer, non-technical user can grasp. So it was about 60 days after I first bought on Coinbase that I got myself a hardware wallet and I had my first on-chain transactions. I really am still personally deficient in how I'd like to be as a Bitcoiner. I briefly had a Razblitz node that something went awry and I didn't get it back in position. So I do rely on other nodes in the sense that any software wallet I use or hardware wallet I use, I'm not connecting to my own node, which to me isn't the best. I don't know.
Yeah,
trying to figure it out.
It's a slow process, mate. It's, you know, these things aren't learned in a day, as you well know. And we are so early. We say it so much.
Yeah.
We are so early, and there is still a long road ahead of us. But these things are becoming easier, and more people are coming into the space and improving what's already there. And not only that, just improving the education as well. I mean, BTC Sessions has some great tutorials. You can just sit there and watch whatever you want and teach yourself how to set up the node, how to set up the multi-sig, how to set up a particular hardware wallet. He'll walk you through everything. And that's what I love about the community so much. And what would you say has been like the biggest kind of change in your thinking or in your life since, you know, the Bitcoin orange pill mind virus has been seeping through your body for the last handful of years?
Okay, well, first I'd say it made me think about money differently. I realized I'm sorry to be so slow to come to words on this. It made me feel like our regular money is just this ever expanding thing that just churns out in the world. And we spend it and we spend it and we chase it and we chase it. And I couldn't help but feel that we're on this like hamster wheel that we never get ahead. It's like that perpetual state of just paycheck to paychecknessness. Like, in other words, you never really get to a point where you're like, oh, over there, I've got my pile of acorns and I'm all right. If something happens, I'll spend from that pile of it. No, in our culture, our money is very much kept from us, and how the only savings many have is their 401ks or other instruments that they're not supposed to touch until they're 65 years old. It's like kind of crazy that you have like, say, a quarter or a half of a paycheck in your checking account and some trivially small amount in a savings account, most average Americans, and then this pile of money over here that you're not supposed to touch that they have incentivized for you to borrow against and like potentially be penalized against. And like, it's just a weird system how it's not really set up for usability. I mean, and I understand the importance of saving for the future. I get that. But it seems like the way it's set up just doesn't really incentivize the right behaviors, you know? So I've become more of a pay yourself first. I feel like the development of DCA platforms, I was already pretty much all in on Bitcoin prior to DCA platforms, but thinking in terms of DCA, cultural things like buying dips, I personally, I appreciate knowing that you have what you have, and that sort of shift of mind where the volatility of the exchange rate from fiat to Bitcoin goes up and down, but you still have the same number of sats. So eventually you learn to be in this tranquil state that you're like, yeah, whatever's happened on the exchange, happened on the exchange, but that doesn't have anything to do with me. Personally, I'm not somebody that says that I will never spend my Bitcoin because it'd be wholly realistic. It's where I pretty much hold the output of my life. But if I am going to spend it, you could bet it's something I really want or really has value to me. Like, in other words, if I wanted to own real estate, I might divest. If I really, really wanted something specific, maybe I would. But it's sort of like the savings I respect. And I've never had that kind of respect for savings. In other words, money, it seems like we don't give it the respect. We just, you just spend it. You just buy it. Like, I don't know. It's really weird.
Yeah, it certainly is. And what about if that that moment happens, we have the rip upwards, you're able to, I mean, you're still, I believe you're still working in a what we'd call a fiat job or not? Have you managed to get yourself?
Well, they're very much so fiat jobs. Like currently I still work in nursing in addition to my maritime work. And that I'm currently working for a government based facility that's delivering, you know, nursing care and healthcare. So yeah, that's pretty much fiat as it gets because it's literally run by the government. And it's kind of a funny thing how it's just so weird. The other day I'm having a conversation with an administrator and I tell her about this book on overcoming complex PTSD that I bumped into. Had 10,000 positive reviews on Amazon. It was said to be excellent. I'm looking in my images to recall the title. So no sooner do I tell her my initial impressions based on the 60 pages that I have read so far, and she says, I'd completely disregard that 100%. Wow. And then she goes on to talk about something regarding evidence-based practice and this, that, and the other thing, and how I could get back on board with some aspects of it when talking about developing tools and being the best we can be or something, you know, some general. It just sort of seemed to me, if you have 10,000 people on Amazon giving it a hugely popular review, to totally disregard it seems odd. Now, maybe there's something specialized about the people we're dealing with, about the severity of their conditions or something to that effect, that maybe you do have to take exception and you cannot take the input of those 10,000 individuals. But to me, that's different than throwing it out 100%. That would be saying, in the context of what we do here, I would disregard that for these specific cases, because of this or that or the other. You know, you don't just, it just seems so crazy. The book was Complex PTSD: From Surviving to Thriving by an author named Pete Walker. He's also the author of The Tao of Fully Feeling. And I don't know if anybody so far what I've got from it, it's about identifying what negative impacts and ineffective coping mechanisms we've developed as a result of our early beginnings, and developing methods to operate differently in light of what, say, our default behaviors are based on what we experienced. Seems really valid to me.
100%, man. Okay. Early beginnings being like birth, basically, right? That's where trauma starts.
Birth, childhood, early experience. I mean, from what I'm reading in this book, and he's well read on other theorists. Like, in other words, this guy's not just going off the cuff. He's naming all the popular names that you hear in a psychological field. In the first 2 years, we really need unconditional love. You're just a young new being and you need whatever you need, and you can't be, you just threw up on this right after, like, come on. As time goes on, we need to add conditions to how we reward behavior. You know what I mean? Like, it can no longer be unconditional. You have to put away your toys before you're going to get that ice cream snack. There's just no way you're getting the ice cream before you put away that mess. Little conditions get added. And it's, if you cannot function in that kind of mode, it makes it hard to be successful in life, in the sense that almost everything in life is very conditional. I'm going to do this for you because you did this for me. There's some degree of like goodwill and so forth. But at the end of the day, people typically pay for results and purchase outcomes. That's the mover. That's the driver in the world. I don't know, man. Interesting.
You're opening a huge rabbit hole, which is really interesting.
Yeah,
to me, because
go for
I was
it.
Recently
you can run with it.
Yeah, I was recently having a conversation about this with Rob Brindid, another Bitcoiner. He lives on Madeira and he's part of the Free Madeira organization. And he does a lot of work around the mind, and he's a Bitcoiner, and he's writing a book called The Decentralized Mind, because he believes we're all like biomagnetically connected nodes, as do some other people that I've been having this kind of discussion with, which is truly amazing that, you know, Bitcoin can start rewiring people's minds this way. And he was talking about the same kind of thing, like trauma happening to all of us in the very early days, i.e. from the very point of birth. And then when we go down the rabbit hole of like modern birthing techniques, and other people have brought this subject up before, and about how sterile it is, and how as soon as you are born, you are taken straight from the mother, the umbilical cord is cut too quickly, and then you're weighed and you're washed and you've injected with some vitamins and this, that, and the other thing, or other injections that they have persuaded you that your brand new, perfectly born baby needs. Freaking trauma, man. Like trauma, like right there. And then if that baby is born to the mother and father who were both working, you know, like ridiculously long hour jobs and have careers and the sunk cost fallacy of looking after their careers, then it's time for mummy to get back to work after the 2 or 3 months that she's allowed out on good behavior, otherwise known as maternity leave. And then you're with a complete stranger for 5 days a week in a completely different area, different place. And like that manifests, that compounds across a generation and across a population and across the globe. It's no wonder we are where we are right now with, you know, society being in such a freaking mess, or like, you know, all of these problems. You're a nurse. How much do you see? Is this why you're going down this rabbit hole of PTSD? Is that what you generally are dealing with or have dealt with?
So my career's taken two steps. So presently I work in a psychological facility where individuals are very severe versions of whatever illness they're suffering. These are people that they're no longer able to be effectively employed. They're no longer effectively managing their emotions. They're good people at the root of it, but they are in a place where they are not doing okay on a day-to-day basis, like running into severe maladaptive issues, and they just kind of need to be somewhere for a very extended time. And sometimes we're talking about up into the months and the years. Like, I don't want to spell it out, but like, wow. In other words, it's basically the deepest level of care when all other measures have failed. Now, the thing of it is it's I can't name anything specific, but yeah, I mean, it's something I think about. That's why I looked at that book. I mean, my previous experience in nursing was medical, surgical, general community hospital. And when you're in that setting, you're also dealing with psychological issues and people in the same dynamics, but to a lesser acuity and a lesser chronic nature. But yeah, it's
we're talking like a real deep anxiety, manic depression, this kind of thing.
You can be talking about any of it. You're talking about about chronic mental illness of any sort you could imagine. It's divided into a number of specialized area of care and populations. So let's just say for a course number, let's just say there was half a dozen buildings, and let's say there's a number of units in each building. They tend to group populations in a way that their needs and issues are similar. So there could say be a geriatric aspect. So in other words, they happen to be elderly with profound needs for care, or they could be people that have had trouble with the law and are a lot younger and often have much more issues with violence. You could see how elderly and youthful violent wouldn't go together so well in that sort of setting. So like, you try to group the type of difficulties and history that the person has had into, I mean, the theory goes, I think, that you're trying to put them into settings with individuals with similar needs. Now, to me, the interesting thing about it is my anecdotal feeling about it is it feels like we're taking of the most intense and serious challenges and putting them in this concentrated space. It's kind of a difficult setting to kind of make headway at it. It's like, it's a really difficult setting. Like I only work there, like let's say 4-6 days a month, and it is very challenging. Like you can sense the frustration of individuals within that system in the sense that it tends to be extremely rigid. It tends to like down to the fact that like certain units, for whatever reason, like they're very metered about like, oh, well, it's after this time, I can't give you lemonade, or like, I don't know, man.
Holy shit, man. And what are they, how do they treat the patients? What's the, I know I it's probably a vast difference, but
they treat them well in the sense that there's an emphasis on being respectful, polite, supportive, and people to varying degrees accomplish those goals. So at the beginning of the day, everybody's starting out with the right idea. But as a consequence of say somebody that works somewhere between 40 and 60 hours a week in a setting repetitively dealing with these types of stressors, like say either of us work in that setting, you chronically get rubbed upon in a way that is stressful. And sometimes it becomes very difficult to be the best version of yourself. You know what I mean? Like we all have a last straw and there's only so far anybody can be pressed. It's a challenging setting. And I get in that place sometimes and it challenges me. It's like you're pushed up against like the intersection of like unfortunate, because I would never wish these sort of challenges on anybody. It's very difficult to live in those shoes. And you wish that you could do it as good as you'd want to. Like, in other words, God, I wish it was better. And I don't have all the answers, but that's why I read a book like Pete Walker's book about PTSD. I'm trying to gain insight to what does help, what can help, because the training is very much pretty. You have whatever training you've received in nursing school in the sense that you know about therapeutic communication, you know about a lot of various physiological things. To me, the career of nursing is a lot about monitoring, measuring, and reporting. You know what I mean? That's kind of the function of it. And you go in there to learn additionally about these specialized skills, and you're taught ways to safely help de-escalate a physical altercation between two people. There's a strong emphasis of respect individual and not doing harm, but it's a very chaotic type of healthcare. It's new to me.
And do they
I've only been
are they giving out medication each day? Is that the way?
Sure.
All right.
Heavy emphasis. Huh. Oh, for sure.
So that's why that administrative lady, that's why she just wants to bash down your book, because it's her job.
Potentially, I can't. Go ahead, I'll listen.
I was going to say she's probably the gatekeeper between like the government funding and the drugs coming in and just keeping that channel open. Who knows? Like it's fiat incentives, right?
Right, and maybe it's not her specifically in that position, but
yeah,
I personally think so. Not to say, well, it's kind of interesting in the sense that if we shift the conversation outside of that specific facility, how much medication has become the answer for all sorts of things, and it isn't to me always the answer. Like in other words, and I get frustrated about how the mainstream messages tell you one thing, tell you another, and it doesn't seem like we're always advocating the best things. Like in other words, like look, walk down a breakfast aisle, like look at those cereals with all that sugar. It's like, come on, man! Like this stuff is horrible. Yeah. Like it's fine for an occasional dessert or something, but like, yeah, I don't know, man. It's heavy business. But I think when we talk about people with challenges, and you see it in education too. Like the kid that has a difficult home life, a child like that is going to be harder to manage in a classroom setting. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like here you are living as a young being in a difficult setting, and then you're being asked to perform in a setting where there's children that have had much better preparations and are much better rested and have better coping skills. Because some of these settings, the good coping skills aren't displayed. So when the kid faces the challenges, additionally, they're not even able to respond as positively as a child that has a better toolkit in that regard. It's
and then what happens? They start fidgeting. They start getting anxious. They start acting up in air quotes, which is not acting up because it's just a natural behavior coping mechanism. And what do you, well, let's shove Ritalin down the necks because that's going to keep them quiet. And we'll call that ADHD and we'll shame the parents. And it's so sick, man. It's, it's all insidiously done to keep this medical monopoly, big pharma just completely rolling. I'm going to shill you a book actually for your PTSD. It's called Niacin, The Real Story by Andrew Saul, S-A-U-L. And there's a few Bitcoiners going down the niacin rabbit hole at the moment. I've been pulled into it myself, and you're going to be out. You will love it, this kind of stuff. So Niacin, N-I-A-C-I-N, The Real Story by Andrew Saul. You'll love that, man. You'll love that. And hopefully, fingers crossed, you know, that will be something that you might be able to bring to your work and apply to that knowledge to the people around you and to the people that you're looking after.
On that note, what I try to do is I purposefully, that job, it's last in line. Like, for example, this Friday, I do assistant captain work for a university in New Jersey. There's some sensory video, whatever the heck the thing's called. I'm going to be towing that for 7.5 hours on Friday, and they're taking some observations. It's Rutgers out of the Marine Field Station by the Little Egg Inlet. That when any of my boat jobs want something from me, that's what I feed first. Mm-hmm. And the mental health and the nursing side of myself, I try to cap that at about 4 to 6 shifts a month. It's a de-emphasized role in my professional self. And by limiting it, I'm able to be the best version of myself. I go in there with an attitude of openness, flexibility, calm, like in other words, and I think it helps me in the sense that I sometimes see people say shout at people or being short with people. Mm-hmm. And I feel that that can really hurt their case for having a good, smooth day without incident within that place. I want things to be as good as possible for myself and my patients. So I always make sure that I come with like as perfect as possible interpersonal skills and respect. And it goes a long way. Personally, that's what I think.
Yeah. Amazing, man. Amazing. Well, let's look to the future then. So hopefully Bitcoin moons. Well, we know it will moon at one stage. It's just, you know, at what time is it a significant enough move that you can concentrate on exactly it is that you want to achieve? And, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds to me as though you definitely want to take some kind of solo trip or family trip or whatever around the world in your boat. So
yes. Yeah. And then that's what I weigh out. Like I'm in a position where I could say take like a year or 18 months off and I wouldn't be ruined. Now, mind you, we're talking about living simply year off, like buying groceries, eating food, basic travel. And that's how successful sailors do. Like anybody that wants to know about an effective voyager, Annie Hill, budget conscious cruiser, is the best book about somebody looking to actually have the chops and get out and do it. It's people with the biggest, flashiest, best, most expensive. Those aren't the folks that make it. It's people with the moderate, the reasonable, the do it themselves. Those folks are the people that go far. So when do I pull the trigger on this? I've kind of become a little addicted to stability and comfort. Part of me almost wants to buy a house, but I view it as like an opportunity to sign up for massive taxation, which I could do, but I don't know if I want to. I don't know. I'm just trying to decide when to pull the trigger to live the dream, because I'm living through this sunk fallacy experience that the dream was born in 2005 fishing in Alaska. I've spent all this time getting into keelboats and buying a boat. And now I've put so much time and effort into this that if I don't at least, you know, sample the Caribbean on my own boat, I've really invested a lot of energy not to cross the finish line. So in other words, I kind of need to cap this off, because otherwise I don't know that I'd feel good about it. Like I've been on this road for a long time of fitting out a boat, buying a boat, working on the boat. It's just like to not go. And so I'm at this point where I just don't know when I'll jump. So right. That's where I'm at.
There's for people listening, because there is a big community out there of families that do this, right? They, as part of their world schooling trip. So you've got people that would do it like we did. We were home swapping and house sitting. You've got people that would do it, van lifers. I've had Nathan Day on the show. Mm-hmm. He's got this beautiful rig that him and his family have traveled around the world in. You know, they're completely self-sufficient. They've got their own water supply on the truck. They've got solar. It's amazing. And then you got people that would
do the same thing
in the boats with families. And I've had Joseph Kelly on the show. He's the co-founder of Unchained Capital. And he did this as a teenager with, I believe, sister. I can't remember.
I've heard that episode. Yes. Right? That was awesome to learn that he had a cruising background. Yes. Yeah. I loved hearing that.
And that's what it's called, right? Cruising, or your cruisers. And there's a great community of people out there. I've met some, because here in Europe, mm-hmm. You just sail up. You could sail around the whole Med, cruising around the whole Med, and meet up with the same group of people, then get out there, stay in a port for a week, do that whole thing, explore that country, get off to the next one. Incredible way to see the world. I would love to do it. We haven't done it. It would mean, obviously, I would have to go and learn to sail, or all of us would have to learn to sail. So then you've got six hands on deck that can get you out of a tight spot. You're very enclosed as well. This is the thing. We're a big family, so that would be another thing to consider.
My best vision for if you wanted to explore anything like that, for the person that's already not an over-the-top interested sailor, get on someone else's vessel and just do a leg of a passage. Mm. I mean, honestly, when I helped that guy Jay move his boat for 60 days, that basically had the same sensation as achieving my dream. The ownership of the boat isn't what makes it fun. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, and there's so many different migratory patterns of boats that you could key into, like any United States listeners, from New England, the Hudson, and so forth down to the Chesapeake. There's a parade of boats that happens in the late fall. Very good networking opportunities. And the same goes for southerly points beyond October and November. If you're looking to get down to Caribbean, Florida, just get on someone else's boat. Sometimes they value somebody that can just simply be awake, pay attention. Mm. Those are the skills you need to be valuable on someone else's boat initially.
Well, let's describe a kind of journey. So you might set off early in the morning, sail for 6, 7, 8 hours, something like that, or to a specific point where you pull into port.
Well, so the first off, 70% of your time is spent sitting still. So when you wish to move your boat to the next spot, if it's a short hop of a single day, somewhere between say 50 and like you're topping out around 80 miles at most, like slow moving craft, you would want to be aware of what weather is coming in. You would want to make sure that you have either adequate rest or ability to cope within the area you're passing through. Say if it's like a low acuity passing of some sort, you might be okay being rather fatigued accomplishing that. But fatigue is one of the worst enemies out there on the water. So you need to fight the urge to do everything yourself. If you're the most qualified aboard, you need to utilize your other human resources. So you develop a watch schedule. And a good way to do it is you have yourself and then say another, and you're the primary for that time. And that other person is just kind of hanging back, hanging out, being relaxed. But if you were to need something, they're right there for you. Then you cycle down to rest. You are out of the picture. Someone else comes into that secondary relaxed spot, and then they are the lead for that next period of time. And you just rotate through in that manner. So you have always somebody that's on high alert, always somebody that's on standby, and always the balance resting and recharging. Basic things like you always look out for one another on a boat. Like say if you're grabbing yourself a snack or a drink, you might want to ask the others, hey, I'm going down to get something to snack on. Does anybody need anything, want anything? Oh yeah, Daniel, I'll take a granola bar. Thanks. You know what I mean? Like it's the human sides of it that really challenge one in the sailing thing, because it's like sailing itself is simply steering, knowing where you are, awareness of elements. It becomes kind of simple down the road because it's not complex. It's just a learned series of activities. And with that said, anybody that wants to gain skills on the water, probably the number one skill to know is like how to be good with line and knot tying. My favorite book is The Morrow Book of Knots by Mario Bigon. It's the most clearly illustrated and it's very good. From there, you just basically, the smaller the boat, the greater the joy. Small boats will teach you so much about how boats behave. If you just cut your teeth in something tiny, under 20 feet, just spend time, learn, do, and you learn how they behave. I don't know. It's a long road, but it's worth doing. All of it's worth doing. I mean, I don't know. One thing I want to touch on, yeah. I would love to hear your initial thoughts on how do van people or sailboat people get the ball rolling to pivot from a traditional state school system and so forth into a distance learning environment. What is the best practices for that sort of thing, or anybody that needs to do that? How do you begin distance learning?
Very good question. Because our own programming, as you know, has been so deep, right? We've, as we were talking about before, you know, we went through that traumatic experiences as young kids, and you get indoctrinated into believing that the only way that a human being can learn is in a classroom with 29 other kids, right? You say the word education to people, and that's what they just imagine, because that's what it's the only thing that they know. So coming to the realization that there could be another way, and in fact, that could be much healthier and far more beneficial for your kid, is a big step into the unknown for yourself in the first place. And it's a pretty dark, lonely place, because if you're the only one as well in the marriage that is thinking that way, it's really very difficult. Very difficult, because, and in my experience, it's generally the guy, the father, is quicker to let go of that programming and to challenge that systematic BS that we've been through. Whereas for the mother, there is so much riding on, you know, the social construct around her and the judgment that is always passed on to the mother first, which is really very, very damaging. So you get locked, you get painted into this corner of just send your kids to the best school you can find. And a lot of people even move house just to move closer to what they deem to be the best school and get trapped in that system. So then extricating yourself from that is huge. And how people get to that point is different to everybody. You know, that there might be certain things that keep happening at school. You might see that your child is completely unhappy. You might just, you might read a book. You might watch a video. You might see Sir Ken Robinson's TED Talk, Do Schools Kill Creativity, which he delivered back in 2006, which unlocked so many families. Then it's still a slow process to extricate out of that. So if anybody listening is considering it, like you said, go on a dummy run, you know, go on a practice run, of homeschooling or world schooling or unschooling. Take the kids out on a sabbatical of some sort. Just say to the school, we're going traveling for 2 months, even if you're not. And, you know, just see how that kind of impacts the whole family. And whether this is something that you want to, you know, carry on pursuing. But research, right? That is the answer to everything. Like, you're trying to research this PTSD book. There's a ton of books out there now with regards to education and how damaging, in fact, the education system is. Pick up a book by John Taylor Gatto, any one of his books. Pick up Peter Gray's book, Free to Learn, or Naomi Fisher's book, Changing Our Minds. These are all books that will arm you with the other side of the coin to, or the other side of the meme that free education is a human right, which is a pretty powerful meme. But yeah, when you dig into that and you start thinking for yourself and for your family, then you can start putting other plans into place. And if you do end up want to completely extricate yourself from the system, that all depends on where you live. For American listeners, it's generally a lot easier. For European listeners, it's illegal to do this in Sweden or Germany or Holland. France are trying to clamp down on it. We have problems here where the authorities want to, you know, reach into your home and check your kids are okay. And, you know, it's like, it's becoming very totalitarian. So there's a lot of moving parts. There's no one perfect answer other than connect with people that are doing it, learn from those that have done it, and read from those, especially people such as Peter Gray and Naomi Fisher, who are clinical psychologists and have come from academia themselves, but are now blowing the lid off, you know, what's actually going on in the system. That would be my advice. And other than that, rip the Band-Aid off and fucking go, because what really do you have to lose? What's your downside?
That applies to both stories, I feel.
Yeah.
What's
the downside? You know, if you take your kids out of school for a year, what's the downside? The education system's not going to be gone. Like, you know, I wish as much as I wish it would just be abolished and we could just free humanity. That's not going to happen. So the downside is your child is out of school for a year, and most people are like, oh, they're going to be behind. No, they won't. They'll come back. They'll come back streets ahead, because that is the story that I've heard time and time again, and I've seen it with my own kids as well.
That's awesome. Thank you for the insight.
You're welcome. And like you were saying about those captains, yeah, you might be a captain in textbook, but when you get them out on the ocean, or, you know, now apply that knowledge. Experiential learning is way more important and way more practical than any kind of textbook learning. So why aren't we at least doing a mix of that stuff, right? No. Now it's all classroom-based. It's madness.
It's insane. It is insane, man. And what cracks me up about that style of education is the classroom intensive focus gets to be on the high horse. You know what I mean? They're patting themselves on the back about, like, oh, look at that. You attained your master's. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Like, God.
That I saw this in my old profession as well. I worked in financial markets and foreign exchange, and you'd get guys come and sit down on the foreign exchange desk and sit between myself and a colleague. We might have been working in foreign exchange markets 6 to 8 years by that point. And I never went to university. You know, at the age of 19, I walked into a trading floor and just worked my way up. And they'll come in with their master's or their PhD in economics and whatever else. Like, right, okay. What are we doing? What trades are we doing? What's going on? And you're like, just sit and learn, man. Just watch what we do, listen to what we say. But it said in the course, yeah, whatever. Can you run down and get two coffees? Like, you know, it's and this would happen all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, doing beats talking always. That's where results are found.
100%. Yeah. All right, man. Well, I got to ask you about Bitcoin loneliness, because I've just been to a conference here in Europe and was in Miami as well. Lucky enough to get across over there. And when you go to these events and you surround yourself with like-minded people, you're flying. You're absolutely flying. In fact, many of us experience a come down. How are you scratching that itch? Where are you finding your Bitcoiners? Are you getting along to events? Have you got friends and family you've managed to orange pill?
So I've done a few things, not many. I went to a Magical Crypto Conference, that whole thing in New York, which was my first public touch point for Bitcoiners. I went to a Ravencoin meetup same year. I want to say it was 17 or 18 out in Salt Lake City. Then I have attended a Philadelphia Bitcoin John once this year, and then my work schedule changed and I haven't been back. So I don't really have a whole lot of real life Bitcoiner peers. There's certain Twitter Bitcoiners that I connect with, either due to like similar trade or background, or just sort of we incidentally recognize we share similar geography, even though we don't meet up in real life. For some reason, it mentally earmarks the person. It's like, oh, we both live in New Jersey. Like, it's weird. The way I've done it is I tend to, up until about 2019, Reddit was a common point to connect to other Bitcoiners. Then it pivoted to Twitter. I really enjoy listening to podcasts. I particularly listen to TFTC with Marty Bent and Matt O'Dell. I listen to you. I listen to Stephen Lavera. I've listened to a number of them, and I hate that I've probably didn't ramble off some of the others that I really like a lot, but I mean, I just kind of like hearing from people what's going on and what's to know. Like, I kind of rely on certain people that are like for example, Rockstar developer with the BTC Pay server. Yeah. You see people from that space and I'm able to learn things about what they're doing. So I try to gather high quality follows on Twitter that I can kind of just let it roll down the hill. You know what I mean? All these people go to the mountain. Oh, and I went to Bitcoin 2020 and 2021 rather. I didn't like it that much. It was all right. But
was that in Miami?
It wasn't. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like the kind of thing where I gave away my ticket for the following year. I mean, the travel expense was something for me at the time. I was moving my boat, and the ticket that I actually attended on was given to me by another Bitcoiner. So I just gave away my ticket the following year.
Right.
I don't know. I've once tried to get the ball rolling, and I still occasionally post to there. So I have this Facebook group, Nurses Discussing Bitcoin, where I tend to use that as my own personal blog, where I put Bitcoin content that I think is valuable or I like, and I just dump it in there. And I think the group's only like 200 people big, and the engagement's really pretty poor, only probably like 6 to 15 likes, something shared in the group. But I think eventually there'll be a vector for Bitcoin education via specific trades or professions. In other words, these are all skills we need to learn. And if we're going to be Bitcoiners, someone needs to show you what not to do. Someone needs to show you what to do. So the vision I had is I was wishing that I could say, go to a hospital and say, be there for say 3 days between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. or whatever the hours would be. You could come on down to the conference center and they'll tell you what you need to know about Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And basically, I talked to a former CEO of my healthcare system and a present CEO of a Jacksonville, Florida healthcare system about giving me the opportunity to gather a small group of Bitcoiners to go down to their hospital and meet with them. And anybody in their organization that wishes to learn about Bitcoin, me and the other Bitcoiners that have chosen to go be president at that hospital that day. We'll talk to you about Bitcoin. We'll answer your questions. We'll help you go from zero to one. And I'd still like to do something like that. I also would love to do that for commercial mariners and tugboaters. I am going to be on a podcast later this month. I'm just in the early stages of broadening my perception of what's going on in the maritime field and trying to pick what direction I want to go in. I'm kind of leaning towards, there's a passenger ferry in southern New Jersey. It has the benefit of being maritime work while still going home every night. Mm-hmm. And I'm also leaning towards ship handling, which is the docking and undocking of large vessels using tugs. And I'm interested in that as well. In other words, I need to find higher responsibility maritime work if I'm going to really grow or earn well or any of that. So like, because this is you just take somebody off the street and I teach them how to do this job. Don't get me wrong. You need boat handling skills. You need skills, but it's not a big position or anything.
Oil. Well, I just flipped open Orange Pill app here and did a search for New Jersey. Mm-hmm. There was three Bitcoiners in New Jersey. DSUK just moved to New Jersey from overseas, and I'm currently looking for job yet Bitcoin space. Dried DRYDE. New Jersey person that does New Jersey things. Orange Pilled a few years ago. Python. Bitcoin equals freedom. Looking to connect with other Bitcoiners in New Jersey. So there's people.
I need to check that app out. I interacted with the developers of that app, and I still haven't overcome it. I was nervous and skeptical about the GPS aspect of an app, and like, it got weird with it. Meanwhile, I'm posting with location on Twitter, so it's like a total hypocrite.
The way it works, and we were showcasing this to some people in Prague, you could be stood right next to the other pleb. So you flick open the app, and I was stood next mm-hmm. to like Knut and I were signing books together.
Yeah,
and I was just showing somebody Orange Pill app. I'm like, look, it says Knut is 5 miles away from me. He's there. So
right.
That's as local as it gets. Like, it's only going to say somebody is within or close to 5 miles of your current
location. It's interesting you mention him. He's another one with a maritime background. That's right. Tall ships and so forth. Like, I think he does that kind of thing. Very cool. I've enjoyed talking with him in the past.
Yeah, exactly. No, yeah, great guy. So, yeah, have a look at it, mate. Have a run at it, because more and more people are coming on, and it's great to know that there's people in your area.
Yeah, well, I value that idea. And something I like about how Bitcoiners tend to operate is how we realize what we bring to the table mm-hmm. and we can benefit from what we need. Like, you know, I've bought...
We understand division of labor, right? That's the perfect thing. Yeah.
Like, I've bought like leather goods from Bearded Hole, and maybe maple syrup from Maple Trade, and crypto cloaks, of course, and like all these different people that make things that you want mm-hmm. and you pay them in Bitcoin and you get their stuff, and it's a cool thing.
I've got some coffee coming from, I'll give a proper shout out and I'll get the actual handle.
Yeah, I've been meaning to get that as well. I think I know the one you're going to say. Keep going.
Jose Bitcoiner, Lightning Coffee.
That's the one at Lightning Coffee. I got to do that.
So, yeah, I've put my order in DMs with him yesterday, and looking forward to that coffee showing up. Love the fact that I'm way overpaying for some coffee. I'm sure it's going to be delicious, though, but supporting a pleb. And we're using Bitcoin as a medium of exchange.
And on that note, if anybody's ever passing through New Jersey, particularly up against the coast, I'm more than glad to sail with people. You know,
yeah,
just a matter for sure. I'll take anybody sailing without a doubt.
What could a day look like if you were to go out sailing?
The best way to do it is I'm not going to just meet a stranger at my family's house where my smaller boat is, but I'd probably personally sail the boat to like either Captain's Inn, Forked River, or say Sunrise Grill over by Barnegat. And I'd meet the people who are interested in coming sailing. We'd then be basically right on the bay. We'd head out into the Barnegat Bay in New Jersey, and we'd sail the waters of that area between Barnegat, New Jersey on the mainland to up to about the Route 37 Mathis Bridge up in Seaside Heights by where the Toms River meets the Barnegat Bay. So could be, you know, just sailing around the bay. If we wanted to and the weather was warm, we could sail over to Tice's Shoal directly across the bay from Forked River, anchor the sailboat and wade into the shore and walk across to the ocean and swim in the ocean and walk back across the little strip of land back to the boat. But yeah, it's just basic day of sailing.
How many people could you take out if there's some Bitcoiners listening and they want a day out and have some beers?
The current boat I have in right now, if you're actively really sailing, four guests is about the cap when the weather isn't fantastic. Mm-hmm. On a pleasant day in July or August, I could do six, considering seating on the coach roof becomes viable when it's mm-hmm. calm and warm. But four is a good number. Three is a good number. When I have my bigger boat back in action down the road, I intend to slip that down in Cape May, New Jersey. That I can take six people day in, day out wonderfully, and I could arrange for overnight passages for interested parties if they wanted to, say, go on a expedition to, say, the Chesapeake or, say, Block Island or something like that. That could be arranged. That's my long-range goal. So I'm about to fabricate a cradle that I own for the bigger boat so I can move it to Cape May for winter storage rather than Barnegat, because the boat that's on land presently with a small refit, the West Sail 32, it's not very good for the Barnegat Bay in the sense that it's an ocean boat. It just wants to point and go. It's deep draft. The Barnegat Bay is shoal. And it's just not enough cruising grounds for that type of boat. You really want to go somewhere with that type of boat. Like sail up to New York Harbor and back, or sail to Delaware and back. Something that you went somewhere. And that's the strength of that kind of boat. So I'm just trying to long range... I basically just want to sail for people. So I that's the journey I've been on, just doing things for my boats and doing things for life. And I'm pretty sure eventually I'll be sailing for people. That's where the road's going.
Let's hope some New York-based Bitcoiners are listening and they reach out and they hook up for a day out talking Bitcoin, having some beers on deck. And
yeah, whatever's good, man. Whatever's good. I'm there. All right. Yeah, man. I mean, all right. Thank you, Daniel.
I'm gonna hit you with the last question.
Go ahead.
If you had one last orange pill left to give to somebody, who would you give it to and why?
One last orange pill, who would I give it to and why? That's a difficult one, man. I guess I'm just going to have to... Maybe this is just a kind of arbitrary one just because of the way we had the conversation. I think I'd give it to that sailor, Kristen Neuschafer, in the sense that she's currently in the spotlight, in the media. She just succeeded in her racing. And I feel like as sailors, sailors have always tied together the world. We cross mm-hmm. oceans, we cross rivers, we cross lakes. I'd want to get it into the hands of sailors. You know what I mean? It just surprises me, given that it's a nationless currency. It seems ideal for people that are moving from nation to nation. Mm-hmm. Would work well among sailors. So maybe if somebody prominent in the sailing world, such as her, said, hey, I've recognized this as a tool that I value and I like it for these reasons, maybe that would have other people who are like me, who are sailors, would want to try it. That's why I choose her.
Awesome, man.
So that's who I'd orange pill.
Sailors get a lot of time to sit out there and think under the stars and clouds too, right?
Yeah, the bulk of maritime anything is waiting, and it's like 95% of the time it's just waiting, and then you're paid for that 5% where you do the right thing and it has to be done right and you're there for the task. So yeah, sailors, you get to think. Like I've been here, I'm in the oil refinery right now. This is my third day in here. I'll be departing tomorrow morning. So it will be when I leave, it'll be 96 hours I've been inside this environment. I will have probably done about maybe 8 hours of work on the water so far.
Right.
So it's very much about waiting.
Damn, you must have some... That's the time where you have that... When you have the books or you have the pods
Oh, that's why I hesitate to evolve further in the sense that my current schedule leaves my weekends clear. I have all the time in the world for personal development. It's enough money to kind of keep the lights on, pay the bills, eat some food, and then I'm able to earn otherwise if I need more money for other things. So if I were to, yeah.
Yeah, we're
Oh,
back.
hey, I was just about to message you. Yeah, the hotspot must be getting flaky.
Yeah, no, you were just wrapping up anyway, just saying you seem to have it all pretty figured out at the moment. Nice rhythm. You've got the job, you get the personal time, you can read, you can educate yourself, you can stack, and Bitcoin's got you.
It just here's the thing, like it's tempting to want to get on the bigger vessels, bigger so forth, maybe for a personal development achievement level, partially for an earnings level, but there's definitely a downside to going up that ladder in the sense that, say, if I switch to hitch work, maritime work, I'm literally on a boat for 14 to 21 to 28 days at a time. And no longer can you run out to Target during your shift because you want something, or no longer are you idle as much as I'm idle now. Like, this is an easy spot I'm in, bro. Like,
All right, hang on to it. Keep
so
stacking those sets, and
I am, man. I am.
we'll see where you are in 2 or 3 years, and hopefully you'll be doing that around the world journey.
I feel like it's pretty likely. I mean, I have the means to, I have the boat to, and I've been focused on it for like over 15 years. So I think that's where the road's going to go. But
Right, man.
thank you
I'm
for your
looking forward
wishes.
to you. I'm
I
looking
wish the
forward
best
to
for you as
you.
well.
Thank you very much. But I'm looking forward to you blogging all of that and visiting all of the Bitcoin hotspots that are going to start popping up all over the world. So fingers crossed, man.
One last thing. I don't know. Are you in the south of the UK if you're commenting, or
We're in
my
France, but
oh, but you're in
we're
France.
yeah,
Okay,
we're
gotcha.
not near the ocean, so there's no sailing on our
Got it. Fair
horizons.
enough. No worries. All right, good chat.
See you, brother. Take care.
All right, later, Daniel. Thank you.
Well, there you go, plebs. You just heard from another pleb. Living the life, trying to figure it all out, trying to move to a Bitcoin standard at the same time, mining fiat. And what a story working in that. I mean, kudos to you, brother. What you're doing there in that psychological facility. Helping those people that are unable to help themselves, and hats off, man, hats off. That's really tough, very tough work. But if anybody wants to reach out to Stormchip, Jen, go ahead, DM him. He's completely open. If you want to ask me any questions, how to get in touch with him, let me know. As you can tell, he's a fully open book. Just another one of us. Trying to do the right thing out there, shill the Bitcoin, live a Bitcoin life, and educate as many other people as possible about Bitcoin. And that's what we're here to do. That's what these podcasts are about. That's what the books are about, articles, songs, dance, music, whatever. Whatever it is that you can bring to this space, please bring it. You will be absolutely supported by the right people as well. Those people that you resonate with will be 100% behind you, and they will be able to help you spread your message. So go find your people. Get on Orange Pill app. You'll be able to find someone near you. If not, you'll be able to find someone next time you're traveling, or find an event near you or something. If not, come back in 2 or 3 months, because the app is always growing. So get out there. Get to a conference. I listed the conferences at the beginning of the show. At current time of release, Biarritz is next in August, then the Baltic Honey Badger in Latvia, and then we have Plan B Lugano Conference, and then we have Amsterdam, and then we have Liberty in Our Lifetime in the middle of October in Prague, put on by the Free Cities Foundation, and then just dropped Bitcoin Atlantis March 2024 in Madeira. Going to be an incredible event. So make sure you are checking all of these conferences out. You can use the code BITTEN for a 10% discount at all, if not many, of the conferences coming up. So make sure you try that code before you check out. And if it's not working or there's no discount, please get hold of me and I'll see what I can do for you. Right, with all of that said, thank you for listening. Please show your support to the show sponsors, Swan Bitcoin, Relay, Coin Corner, and Hodl Hodl. You have Wasabi Wallet there to guide you through your first coin join, if that's a new service for you. And you have mempool.space to help educate you about the Bitcoin blockchain and tracking your transactions. Get over to Consensus Network. Their YouTube channel is hosting the video versions of these podcasts. And you can check out their offerings on their bookshop. Hit the link in the show notes and you'll get a 10% discount. Pay via Lightning and you'll get a further 10% discount. So go get yourself a book. There's no excuse. Catch you on the next show, guys. Thank you so much for listening.